It's 2026, and we're about to have our three-year anniversary of our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders. So to celebrate, we're offering the first 1,000 members who sign up free house officer privileges for 1 month. That lets you get access to 70-plus bonus episodes where Paul and I recap high-yield pearls, answer listener questions, and give our picks of the week. It's a lot of fun, so check us out at patreon.com/curbsiders. Or you can click the link in the episode description to sign up. Paul, why did the adrenal gland break up with the pituitary?
Oh my God, a topical one. Wait, why did the adrenal gland break up with the pituitary? Shoot. I feel like this one I could puzzle out, but I sense your impatience. Tell me.
It felt like it was being controlled.
I would not have gotten there. Great stuff.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity, aside from possibly Cash Like More Hospital and its affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Matthew Frankwato, here with my great friend and America's primary care physician, probably the primary care physician, Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Hey, Paul.
Yeah, probably. Hey, Matt. How are you?
I'm doing well, Paul. This was some really new territory for me tonight. Mild autonomous cortisol secretion with Dr. Irina Bankos. And you know, Paul, we've done a bunch of adrenal episodes. I feel like this fits right in there. And we're just really like upping our adrenal game like every time, aren't we?
We need to be doing more dexamethasone suppression tests. Like they just, I feel like everybody should be getting them at this point now. So I'm glad that we could preach the gospel about that at least.
Yeah. I think in primary care, you know, this episode should convince you that we need to be owning at least the first line testing for this before we send them to Dr. Bankos to get their adrenal gland, to convince them to get their adrenal gland taken out. But Paul, what is it that we do on Curbsiders? And would you introduce our co-host?
Yeah, Matt, we are, as a reminder to our audience, the internal medicine podcast. We use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. As you allude to, we had a great expert tonight, and we also have a great co-host. We are joined by endocrinologist extraordinaire, Dr. Mobeen Ahmad. Mobeen, how are you?
I'm doing great. You know, just trying to avoid the snow, I guess. We're recording this right after the snowstorm of the century, I guess.
Yeah, or the year, at least.
Hopefully, you know, by the time this one comes out, hopefully, it will be less, there will be less snow, but you never know in Pennsylvania. All right. So, Mobeen, would you tell us about our guest?
Yes. So today we have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Irina Bankos. She is a professor of medicine and an adrenal endocrinologist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. She received her medical degree from Iuliu Hetiganu University of Medicine and Pharmacy in Romania, completed her internal medicine training at Danbury Hospital in Connecticut, and completed her endocrinology training at the Mayo Clinic. She truly is a leader in the field of adrenal pathologies and has been a key author of the European Society of Endocrinology's clinical practice guidelines on the management of adrenal incidentalomas. And it's also written a lot about the topic that we will be discussing today. In addition, she has authored over 275 articles and truly is a mentor and a role model, I think, for countless endocrinologists and endocrinology fellows like myself.
All right. So without further ado, let's get to it. A reminder that this and most episodes will be available for CME credit for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. Irina, great to have you here. Thank you so much for struggling with us through technical difficulties. You sound great, and the audience wants to know, what is a hobby or interest that you're currently enjoying outside of medicine?
That's a great question. I was thinking about it, preparing for this podcast. And I'll be honest, a lot of what used to be hobby time for me has turned into what I call team science. I spend a lot of time, a lot of my free mental space thinking about mentorship and team development and how to build projects that can truly transform care for patients with adrenal disorders, especially in this challenging funding environment. And much of this work isn't formally required, but I do it because I'm deeply passionate about mentorship, career development, and creating teams that function sustainably. In terms of more traditional hobbies, the one that was a constant throughout my life has been reading, or more like listening, audiobooks. I have a pretty extensive audiobook library and listen while driving or in between busy days. And what I would really like getting back to is ballroom dancing. I used to dance quite a bit earlier in my life. That's actually how I met my husband, at a ballroom dance school. I also hope to return to clay modeling and painting and learning new art techniques. I think those creative outlets would bring me sort of a different type of joy, maybe something I'll have more space for later in life, or at least I hope so.
I hope you get back to those two. That sounds, that all sounds wonderful.
We can all meet and dance, ballroom dancing.
Paul, you're a big ballroom dancer, aren't you?
No, Matthew, I am not. I would be if I could be. I was born without rhythm, but I admire those that can.
Actually, Paul, someone sent me an AI video. A mutual friend sent me an AI video of you doing a wild dance. Did that make it your way as well?
It did, yeah. I found it deeply upsetting. Yeah, as anyone who actually knows me, they know I don't like pictures or videos of me. So the fact that someone went to the effort of actually transforming into something even more egregious, I actually found hurtful. But glad it made its way to you.
For the audience, it was former guest J.J. Nunez.
And former friend.
And former friend. Okay. But back to us. Sorry for that detour there, but it just made me think of it. Paul?
Yes, I will ask my standard question. I would love to hear about meaningful advice or feedback, either that you've received or that you like to give, that you could share with our audience that they find useful.
Yeah, and I have a good one. The one I received some time ago and the one that I'm frequently giving to my mentees. So one of the most meaningful pieces of advice I received, especially when I transitioned or as I was transitioning from junior to mid-career, was to clearly define my vision and mission, and to revisit them regularly as my career evolves. And this advice has been incredibly grounding. It helps me decide which projects to take on, those that are meaningful to me, aligned with my values, and have the potential to make a real difference. It also makes it much easier to say no and avoid being pulled into many directions. For example, when you asked me to record this podcast on mild autonomous cortisol secretion, I said yes almost immediately because it clearly fits within my mission. Disseminating science, advancing education on adrenal disorders, helping to develop the next generation of endocrinologists are core to what I care about. So using that lens has helped me move forward in a more intentional and sustainable way rather than simply reacting to different opportunities as they come.
Can I ask your process for revisiting that mission? I love that so much, by the way. Like, I was just thinking about how sort of writing my teaching philosophy the last time I went up for promotions was really clarifying. But I mean, I guess, what is your process, or do you even have one for revisiting? Like, how often you kind of go back and check in and say, does this still align with my mission? What is my current mission? Is that something you do with intention, or just something that kind of, as your career evolves, you think about it again?
Both. So for example, last time I had to do it because I had to, is when I submitted my promotion package for professor. So that happened now 2 years ago or so. I really had to think, okay, this is my reflection over the last 5 years. What is the next 5 years looking like? So that was a major sort of rethinking and looking forward at opportunities, at what my institution wants from me, what I want from myself, and so on. But I don't think we should be forced to change or to think about our mission and vision. I find it a good time of the year to do it around New Year's time. You know how people think about new resolutions? I think about, you know, is it still valid, what I wrote down 1 year ago? If not, why did it change? You know, what is my thought process and why? So reflecting on the past and thinking about the future is something that I feel is helping me love what I do.
Fantastic. And speaking of the future, this thing we're talking about today it's something that I've been looking forward to, because this is something that I only learned about maybe like a year ago or so, and I'm still trying to grapple with like what it means and what we need to do with it. So let's get to a case from Cashlack Mobine and let's start talking about the main topic.
So the first case that we have today is Miss Addie Rennell. She is a 48-year-old female with a past medical history of well-controlled hypertension, type 2 diabetes, hyperlipidemia, and obesity. She presents to the clinic for an annual follow-up. She was involved in a motor vehicle accident about a month earlier and was told to see her PCP regarding an adrenal lesion that was noted. Her only medications are amlodipine 5 milligrams daily, atorvastatin 20 milligrams, and metformin 1,000 milligrams daily. Vital signs are normal, with a blood pressure of 120 over 75, heart rate 80 beats per minute, respiratory rate 14 breaths per minute. On physical exam, it's positive just for generalized obesity, with her BMI being 34. However, there's no abdominal striae, bruising, dorsal clavicular fat padding that you can notice. On review of her CT of her abdomen pelvis without contrast, she is noted to have a 2-centimeter right adrenal lesion measuring 5 Hounsfield units. Workup of the adrenal lesion is only positive for a cortisol of 1 milligram after a 1 milligram dexamethasone suppression test of 4 micrograms per deciliter with an adequate dexamethasone level of 4 nanomoles per liter. DHEAS is also measured and is low at 20 micromoles per liter, along with an ACTH level being low at 5 picograms per milliliter. A 24-hour urine cortisol is also performed in all of this, and it's normal at 35 micrograms over 24 hours. So I guess the first question that we kind of have for you, Dr. Bancos, is kind of addressing what exactly an adrenal incidentaloma is and kind of what is your approach to patients with adrenal incidentalomas.
Yeah, thank you. And really well-described case. So an adrenal incidentaloma is an adrenal mass that is discovered incidentally on cross-sectional imaging, most commonly a CT scan, that was performed for a reason unrelated to suspected adrenal disease. That's why it's called incidentaloma. And whenever we see an adrenal incidentaloma, we have to approach it from two key perspectives. First, is it benign? Or is it malignant? And that assessment primarily relies on imaging characteristics, things like size, density measured in Hounsfield units on non-contrast CT scan, interval growth over time, if available. And actually, this part is commonly commented on in radiology reports. So I don't find that this part is ignored. But it's the second question, is the mass hormonally active or not, that people forget about. Because, you know, there are not so many tumors in our body that originates from tissue that can produce hormones, right? So this is one of them. So the second question, is the mass hormonally active or not, relies on standard of care workup for hormonal excess in three main categories: cortisol excess, aldosterone excess, and catecholamine excess. And just to give you an idea, based on multiple large population-based or system-based studies, only around 15% of people with adrenal incidentaloma would actually have at least one evaluation for hormonal tests. So certainly a lot of patients do not get the second question answered or raised. Every patient with adrenal incidentaloma should be assessed along both of these axes: malignancy risk and hormonal activity.
And this is regardless of the size of what we see there, because sometimes they might say nodule, sometimes mm-hmm. they say thickenings, sometimes they say mass.
Yeah, that's a great question. and sometimes different radiologists say different things. Mm-hmm. So one radiologist may say thickening that another radiologist may say as a nodule. I guess my recommendation is to look yourself, but not everyone is comfortable interpreting CT imaging, and we do rely on radiology reports. So I will answer two different ways. First, the guideline way says that all of those things we should be worried about only if the nodule is at least 1 centimeter in size or larger. So that also means that based on the guidelines, you should ignore a tumor which is 9 millimeters, right? So yeah. Now, from my point of view, I think if you see it, It is there, so you cannot ignore it. And even cancer starts small. And we may just be very lucky that we found an adrenal nodule that wants to be eventually a 10 centimeter tumor at 9 millimeters. So I would say that if you see it and if it's described in radiology report, probably deserves evaluation. But again, the guidelines say 1 centimeter and above. And as far as thickening, I think that one deserves probably a discussion with radiologists. What does it mean? Is it really nodular thickening? Is it just maybe a generous adrenal gland for whatever reason? And I guess decision-making could be based on that.
And in terms of the hormonal workup, can you remind us, is it all hormones for all incidentalomas, or do certain characteristics sort of push you down a cortisol versus a pheopath, or what is your approach in terms of the hormonal workup, just to remind us?
Yeah, great question. So actually, not every patient needs evaluation for all three axes. So just to go with the three, let's start with evaluation for catecholamine excess with plasma metanephrines or urine metanephrines. Only patients with adrenal tumors and Hounsfield unit above 10, so indeterminate adrenal tumors, need assessment for pheochromocytoma or catecholamine excess, because pheochromocytomas are not lipid rich. It means if you see a tumor with Hounsfield units under 10, you can skip evaluation for metanephrines. Now, if you're not sure, let's say it's contrast only CT scan, or you're just not sure about the Hounsfield units, I guess it's better than to test for metanephrines. But you may avoid testing 70% of people for catecholamine excess, because that is a prevalence of patients with lipid-rich tumors that cannot be pheochromocytoma. So that's one for catecholamine excess. Only those with indeterminate-looking adrenal tumors need evaluation for catecholamine excess. Number two, primary aldosteronism. So aldosterone excess, only those patients with hypertension or hypokalemia, usually hypertension and less so hypokalemia, need evaluation for primary aldosteronism. And based on the new guidelines on primary aldosteronism, you don't even have to have an adrenal tumor. If you have hypertension at least once in your life, you have to be tested for primary aldosteronism. And that would be morning aldosterone and renin plasma activity. And then finally, the easiest one is cortisol excess. Everyone needs it. No matter how the tumor looks and what symptoms you have to have dexamethasone suppression test. And I know this is the topic about MAX. So we would diagnose MAX based on abnormal dexamethasone suppression test. But we'll talk about it more a bit later, right?
That's a fantastic breakdown of everything. And the 10 Hounsfield units, that sticks out in my mind. And it was Dr. Young that we talked about. I think it was number 377 for the audience. And so less than 10 Hounsfield units, that suggests lipid rich. And that's where we're thinking that this could be cortisol producing or aldosterone producing, or just producing nothing, but it should be something benign, not a malignancy or a pheo. We're sponsored by Panacea Financial. It's the end of a long shift. You open your banking app to check your balance and realize you have no idea when the next deposit is hitting, whether your savings are doing anything, or who you'd call to even find out. Good luck finding out tonight, because it's 11 p.m. Listen, I'm a doctor. I've been through residency training. I've been through medical school. And along the way, I've always been fastidious about my banking. I like to know where my money is. I like to know what it's doing. So I like an app that helps me do that. And I like a bank that has good communication. If you're a physician or physician in training, you know your financial life doesn't look like anyone else's. So you want a bank that's going to work with you. So there's a better option out there. And right now, it comes with a $100 bonus just for opening an account. Panacea Financial's deposit accounts were built for doctors by doctors at every stage of the journey. So whether you're a third-year med student, budgeting between rotations, or an attending finally ready for a bank that matches your level of dedication, Panacea Financial gets it. Panacea's high-yield savings rate is over 8 times the national savings rate, which means your money works for you even when you're post-call and can barely think straight. They have no minimum balance requirements, no overdraft fees, no maintenance fees, and the free nationwide ATM access means you're covered whether you're at home or away on a rotation. The mobile-first app lets you manage everything between rounds or at 2 a.m. in the call room. Applying takes minutes and is done entirely online. There's no branch visit, no hassle. There's no wasted time that you don't have. Visit PanaceaFinancial.com today to claim your $100 bonus and start banking built for the way you actually live and work. Panacea Financial is a division of Primis Bank, member FDIC. $100 bonus requires a qualifying direct deposit. Terms and conditions apply. National average based on FDIC information as of January 27, 2026. This episode is brought to you by Masterclass. There's always something you want to get better at. There's always something we want to learn about. That's why we listen to Curbsiders. That's why I do Curbsiders. For me, I was really interested in gut health, not only because I can use it in my practice, but I can use it in my everyday life. So I went to Masterclass and found a class taught by the world's best on gut health. And some of the takeaways were that there's lots of fermented foods that I can enjoy, whether it's kombucha, whether it's sourdough bread, whether it's yogurt, and these are things you can make at home too. The Masterclass courses are easy to adjust because they fit into your real life. They have audio mode, short lessons. You can listen to them on your phone or TV. I was listening to these on my commute and I didn't have to carve out hours. They're short lessons and I could go through them easily. I just had to start. This upcoming Mother's Day or Father's Day, this is a great gift for that special person in your life because moms and dads, they love learning too and they want to improve themselves the same ways that we do. They're going to be exposed to the world's best instructors, and unlike learning from other platforms, Masterclass puts you in the room with people who define their fields, not just experts, but the best in the world. There's 200 plus classes across 13 categories, business, writing, cooking, creativity, wellness, and more, with plans starting at just $10 a month and billed annually. It fits into any schedule. It actually works. 3 in 4 members feel inspired every time they watch, and 83% have applied something they've learned to their real lives, and I'm one of those 83%. There's no risk. Every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Another course I really enjoyed was Sales and Persuasion with Daniel Pink. One of the key takeaways there was that, hey, when you're selling something, you're actually not trying to manipulate something. You're not just trying to close the deal. You need to show empathy to the other person. You need to put yourself in their shoes, take their perspective so you can understand what they need and help them realize what they need to help them solve their problem. And it's a win-win when you do that for the client. And Masterclass keeps adding new classes, so there's never been a better time to get in. Right now, as a listener of this show, you get at least 15% off any annual membership at masterclass.com/curb. That's 15% off at masterclass.com/curb. Head to masterclass.com/curb to see the offer. We gave some labs here, right, that we already got for this person, and maybe we should start talking about that and how that relates to Max.
Right. Dr. Bankos, like we were kind of discussing with this patient, the only thing that came back positive in terms of her adrenal workup was the 1 milligram dexamethasone suppression test, which was 4 micrograms per deciliter, after the 1 milligram the night before, and an adequate dexamethasone level. So kind of, I guess our next question is kind of what exactly is mild autonomous cortisol secretion and how does it differ from the traditional Cushing syndrome as has been described before?
Yeah, so mild autonomous cortisol secretion, or MAX, we will call it, refers to cortisol production from an adrenal nodule or nodules that occurs independently of pituitary stimulation. So first, maybe we should remember what is normal. Normal is for pituitary gland to produce ACTH. ACTH travels to adrenal glands and tells our adrenal glands to produce cortisol. And that cortisol is being produced in a circadian manner with peak cortisol in the morning and then slow decline of cortisol production through the evening and very little cortisol production overnight. While when there is an autonomous cortisol-producing nodule, this cortisol will be produced from the adrenal nodule no matter what day or time of the day or night it is. And in this particular patient with dexamethasone suppression test of 4 micrograms per deciliter, we know that that adrenal nodule produces constant amount of 4 micrograms per deciliter of cortisol. And sometimes it's too much, and that would be during the evening and during the night. So traditionally, MAX has been defined as sort of biochemical cortisol excess without features, overt features of clinical Cushing syndrome. However, our own research showed that the line between what we call overt features of Cushing syndrome and absence of that is kind of blurry, especially in the current era where a lot of patients take weight loss medications, may not present with abdominal obesity or with sort of classical features of Cushing syndrome. I think it's more and more difficult to distinguish a patient with just abdominal obesity versus abdominal obesity because of overt Cushing's. And classical features of overt Cushing's, such as striae, or let's say thinning of the skin, are not that common. So, for example, striae can usually seen in under 5% of all patients with overt features of Cushing syndrome. So, as a result, distinction between MAX and Cushing syndrome can be difficult to draw. So, this is why it's more important to look at our pretest probability, at the existence of adrenal mass, at the full workup, and comorbidities and symptoms.
And I think, you know, one thing that, you know, people might ask, and I think something that is important to address is, you know, they might be thinking, okay, you have this little bit of cortisol excess. You know, like, why is it important for us to recognize that? What does it lead to long-term in patients? And kind of like, how common is it exactly in our adrenal incidentaloma patients?
Yeah, so first of all, how common it is? It's actually quite common. It's not a rare disorder. So we know based on three very large studies, one population-based, one sort of CT-based in the younger population, and one of a patient was newly diagnosed with adrenal incidentaloma. We know that prevalence of MAX in those studies varied between 19% and 44%. So it's certainly at least one in five patients with an adrenal adenoma will have MAX, maybe higher than that, depending on the setting you're seeing this patient there. So it's not something that is rare, and this is why really screening everyone with adrenal incidentaloma is recommended. Now, why is it important to recognize? Well, because it's not been a benign biochemical curiosity. It's associated with an increased cardiometabolic risk, impaired quality of life, disturbances in sleep, overall well-being, and much like other major risk factors such as diabetes, hypertension, smoking, MAX represents a potentially modifiable contributor to long-term morbidity. And recognizing it gives clinicians an opportunity to intervene, whether through surgical consideration or just careful modification of MAX-associated comorbidities to improve patient outcomes, really.
Yeah, that. So, because adrenal incidentalomas are very common in my experience as a primary care doctor, and there's so many patients are getting CT scans, so we can expect we're going to see these adrenal incidentalomas, and we'll be working them up in primary care. That's part of why we wanted to do this show and why we've done other adrenal shows. So, my question is for this MAX and Cushing's. Is it do we think it's a spectrum where eventually patients who have MAX they might develop overt Cushing's? We just don't know which patients. And can you tell us? You mentioned that striae are only like 5% of people with Cushing's. So what are the most common symptoms that would make you think someone has overt Cushing's?
Yeah, so let's start with that. What are the symptoms of overt Cushing's? So the list is the following. Supraclavicular pads, dorsocervical pad, abdominal obesity, moon facies, thinning of the skin, easy bruising, maybe thrush, striae, as I mentioned, those are quite uncommon. And then if it's really severe, you will see edema, you will maybe see signs of vertebral fractures with kyphosis. But as far as how common these in one single patient, very uncommon. So most of the patients with overt Cushing syndrome probably would have supraclavicular pads, maybe dorsocervical pad, maybe a little bit of moon facies and abdominal obesity. And it is a good thing that we are diagnosing patients with Cushing syndrome earlier in their natural history before they develop multiple complications and signs of more overt features. But it also means that it is difficult to distinguish Cushing's between MAX. Mm-hmm. Now, how many patients with MAX progressed to Cushing's syndrome. It's very uncommon. In a systematic review and meta-analysis that I actually participated in as well a couple of years ago, we have demonstrated that it's well under 0.5% of all patients with MAX that would progress to Cushing's syndrome. In clinical practice, the main group at risk for progression appear to be patients with bilateral macronodular adrenal hyperplasia, because this is a naturally progressive disease. Those patients develop more and more nodules and more cortisol production. So eventually, depending on how quickly progressive this disease is, those patients will develop overt Cushing's. And sometimes it takes a couple of years to go from MAX to overt features, sometimes a couple of decades, depending on individual natural history of that disease. So why some adrenal tumors want to be MAX and other overt Cushing's? Probably this depends on why the tumor actually appeared, on underlying somatic mutations.
So our patient, we gave a bunch of labs about this patient. A reminder, this is Addie Rennell, 40-year-old woman. The CAT scan showed a 2-centimeter right adrenal mass, I guess we could call it. It's 5 Hounsfield units. And the workup that was sent was they had a DHEAS that was 20. They had an ACTH level that was low. And then we did a dexamethasone suppression test, and that came back at 4. So can you talk us through interpreting those labs and if there were any other labs you would have done?
Yeah. So I would like first to point out that the only test that is required for MAX diagnosis is 1 milligram dexamethasone suppression test. So in this particular case, this patient's cortisol following 1 milligram dexamethasone was 4 microns per deciliter. Now, in addition to documenting abnormal dexamethasone suppression test that you can trust after excluding false positives or poor absorption of dexamethasone, we have to exclude ACTH dependence. So this particular patient had ACTH and DHA sulfate on the lower side. Not completely undetectable from what I recall, but certainly in the lower reference range. So this would be consistent with MAX, with autonomous cortisol production independent of pituitary stimulation. So we excluded ACTH dependence. Now, another test that this patient had was 24-hour urine cortisol. Now, 24-hour urine cortisol is one of the 3 recommended tests for evaluation of Cushing's syndrome, but it's actually not recommended or is useful in patients with MAX. Why? Because majority of patients with MAX have normal 24-hour urine cortisol production. So I find it interesting to explain why, because I think it's important to understand what happens with cortisol secretion in a patient with MAX. So what happens, because ACTH production is lower than what it should be, patients with MAX actually have lower than necessary cortisol production during the morning. So they don't have this peak cortisol that we normally have. They have sort of stunted cortisol production during the morning. And on the other hand, during the afternoon, evening, and night, they have higher than necessary cortisol production, but not really into the range of someone with moderate to severe hypercortisolism. Maybe 2 to 3 times higher cortisol production in the afternoon, evening, and night. So how does it all translate into area under the curve? Well, if you have lower cortisol production in the morning when you're supposed to have this peak, and slightly higher cortisol production in the evening at night, area under the curve is actually similar to those without MAX. It's just redistribution of cortisol is what matters here. So really, MAX is not a disorder of hypercortisolism. It's a disorder of abnormal circadian cortisol production. And I think it's important to know that, because that explains not only that why 24-hour urine cortisol is normal, but it also explains why patients with MAX present with really what we see with aging. So MAX is sort of like accelerated aging type of disorder. Because with age, we also have abnormal circadian cortisol production and actually develop those comorbidities that are otherwise associated with MAX. So to add another test, which is late-night salivary cortisol, many patients with MAX would have normal salivary cortisol at night. And I guess I would be wondering why, because this is where the problem is, right? Patients with MAX have elevated cortisol during the evening and at night, exactly when the late-night salivary cortisol is obtained. But the problem there is that salivary cortisol is just not accurate enough test to detect the elevation. For example, in our study that is still unpublished, we found that salivary cortisol in patients with MAX is 3 times higher than in patients without MAX. But there is so much overlap, and the cutoff for abnormal salivary cortisol is set at a higher level to diagnose Cushing's, not MAX as well. So this is why I would not recommend measuring late-night salivary cortisol in patients with MAX, because it just would not be helpful. Many patients without MAX may have higher salivary cortisol because of stress or insomnia or partying, and many patients with MAX would have cortisol that is lower than what we currently considered cutoff of abnormal.
Okay, so unless they have clinical symptoms of Cushing's that we went through, we should not be getting that test. The dexamethasone suppression test, can you talk a little bit about how that's accomplished and any pitfalls in interpreting that?
Yeah. So dexamethasone suppression test relies on administering 1 milligram dexamethasone at 11 o'clock in the evening. And then the next morning, patient would have their cortisol and dexamethasone concentrations, if available, checked at around 8 o'clock. So it's really standard of care test. There's a 9-hour difference between dexamethasone administration and cortisol measurement. The idea is that dexamethasone, which is a synthetic glucocorticoid, cortisol-like hormone, as it's being absorbed overnight, communicates to the pituitary gland not to produce any ACTH, because it's not necessary. There is floating dexamethasone around, and 1 milligram is supraphysiological dose. So once pituitary gland understands that, ACTH production becomes zero. And as such, adrenal glands should produce zero cortisol, or at least under 1.8 microns per deciliter, which is considered cutoff of abnormal. So if we measure cortisol and it's actually above this cutoff, then we can conclude that it's crazy, sort of it's autonomous, it's coming from this adrenal nodule and it's not normal.
And what are we doing with the DHEAS in the mix? Can you just sort of remind me the expected physiology and what abnormal would mean with that, please?
Yeah. So DHA sulfate, I call it hemoglobin A1C of ACTH. So you know how fasting glucose, how hemoglobin A1C is an average of glucose levels. Well, DHA sulfate is sort of a manifestation of how much ACTH adrenal gland is seeing. Because DHA production, adrenal androgen production, is fully dependent on ACTH stimulation. So what is the difference between ACTH and DHA sulfate? Well, it's kind of like telling us the same thing, how much ACTH is being produced and how much DHA sulfate is being produced because of ACTH stimulation. But the differences are that ACTH is a worse assay than DHA sulfate, and DHA sulfate has less circadian variability and a longer half-life. So DHA sulfate is supposed to be a more accurate representation of ACTH exposure. So if there is autonomous cortisol production from the adrenal mass that suppresses ACTH, then adrenal glands see less ACTH than they should, and as such, adrenal androgens should be produced at a lesser levels. That's the sort of thinking behind DHA sulfate measurement. And indeed, if we look at patients with MAX, their DHA sulfate levels are much lower as a group than in patients with non-functioning adrenal tumors or patients without adrenal disorders. If we look at sort of the average DHA sulfate levels in patients with MAX, is anywhere between undetectable and 60. But there is no one specific cutoff that absolutely diagnoses MAX or absolutely excludes MAX. In our systematic review and meta-analysis, we showed that at cutoff of 60 microns per deciliter, we have 85% or so sensitivity and specificity. But again, it means we have 15% or so false positives and false negatives. So I would encourage not to think about any endocrine task as black and white, but as a continuum, mm-hmm. and look at everything together.
Was that 6-0 or 1-6-16?
6-0 micrograms per deciliter. And remember that's, you know, different labs have different units mm-hmm. and assays.
Okay. Thank you. That's very helpful. This episode is brought to you by Branch Basics. And listen, in the Watto household, we have a bunch of kids. We want to make sure it's safe. And the last thing I want is a bunch of harmful chemicals under my sink, making me worried that my kids are going to drink it because my kids aren't always the smartest. No offense to my kids. The cleaning products under your sink, sometimes they can be the most harmful products in your entire house. In the US, cleaning companies, they're not required to disclose every ingredient in their formulas. So that means when you see the word fragrance, it can legally represent dozens of undisclosed chemicals, and many conventional cleaners contain ingredients linked to hormone disruption, respiratory irritation, and indoor air pollution. So, while you're trying to make your home cleaner, you could actually be making it less safe. And that's why Branch Basics exists. It was founded by three women who experienced firsthand how much everyday products can impact health. So they wanted to make something that was consistent with promoting overall wellness. Branch Basics makes human-safe cleaning products for your entire home. All their products are plant and mineral-based, fragrance-free, and made safe certified, which means it's screened against known and suspected harmful chemicals. And instead of a cabinet full of mystery formulas, everything is built around one powerful concentrate. You simply dilute it to clean your bathroom, kitchen, laundry, floors, windows, etc. So this spring, don't just declutter your shelves, reset what you're bringing into your home, because a truly clean home should also be a healthy and safe one. And here's the good news. Branch Basics is now available everywhere you shop at Target, Target.com, Amazon, and of course, BranchBasics.com. Tossing the chemicals has never been more convenient. And for anyone grabbing the premium starter kit, you can get 15% off at BranchBasics.com with our code CURB. Just use code CURB for 15% off the premium starter kit at BranchBasics.com. After your purchase, when they ask where you heard about them, please make sure to mention our show. Why don't we go on a little bit? So let's give you a little more history. We discuss a little further with the patient, and she says she's been gaining weight recently and is worried that maybe this is related to this adrenal nodule that we found, and she wants to know about treatment. So how would you talk to her about that?
Well, first of all, what do the guidelines say? The guidelines say that if the patient has MAX and we're convinced about it and has at least some comorbidities related to MAX, such as obesity, weight gain, diabetes, hypertension, then we should consider adrenalectomy. If the patient does not want adrenalectomy after discussing about pros and cons, then we have to monitor for comorbidities associated with MAX and treat those aggressively. So adrenalectomy is high on the list of recommendations. Now, how do I talk about adrenalectomy with my patients? I talk in the following way. So I say that, look, as a group, if we clone you and we make 100 people just like you, and 50 of you have adrenalectomy and 50 of you do not, the ones who do have adrenalectomy have probably around 20 to 60% chance to improve hypertension, to improve diabetes, to improve obesity, dyslipidemia, or at least stop their progression, but not 100%. On the other hand, in the 50 of you who decided not to have surgery, we know that as a group, all of those things would get worse. 5 years later, there is a threefold likelihood that your diabetes will get worse in comparison to those without MAX, twice more likelihood to develop worsening obesity, hypertension, and three times more likely to have cardiovascular events. But it doesn't mean that it will happen to you specifically, just as a group. So why we cannot guarantee success or worsening? Because we really don't know if that hypertension, for example, is because of MAX or would be there independent of MAX. So it also means that if we fix it, hypertension may not go away because it was never due to MAX. And there is no test that we can do before adrenalectomy to prove us causality, to say that it's because of Max you have all of this. So I sort of talk in probabilities with my patients and let them decide what they're comfortable with. And sometimes we have other factors, such as how young the person is. Maybe adrenal mass does not look completely reassuring, and we would like to consider adrenalectomy also because adrenal mass is indeterminate and we cannot completely exclude malignancy. Or maybe there is a strong preference that patient has. Or maybe there are other things such as insomnia, quality of life issues that we are hopeful related to Max, and that could be a good reason to consider adrenalectomy.
Paul, does this seem straightforward to you? the decision, I mean. I'm following the reasoning. I just mean the decision.
It sounds like a tough conversation, but not that our job is to sell patients on the surgery necessarily, but it sounds like it would be... I'd be curious to sort of see the initial patient reactions to that and what percentage actually opt for surgical resection. I'm sure you have those numbers.
In my clinic, 95% opt for surgery after I'm done discussing.
Wow. Whoa.
So just refer to Mayo. Great.
But, you know, I have a pre-selection bias. I think by the time patients decide to travel to Mayo Clinic for this opinion, they want to be more aggressive. So I certainly do not think that 95% adrenalectomy choice is what endocrinologists around the world would see. I do want just to add another way to look at it. I feel that whenever I talk about Max, it's very similar how I would talk to a patient about treating their mild diabetes. For example, if we have someone with hemoglobin A1C of 7.8%, we can talk about controlling their diabetes under a certain cutoff of hemoglobin A1C. And usually we talk not because they'll feel better if their hemoglobin A1C is 5.8, but because we are hoping that by controlling their diabetes, those patients will have fewer strokes, fewer heart attacks. So we're talking about the future, right? We're really controlling the risk for those things to develop. I think Max is very similar to that. We don't necessarily guarantee that a lot of things would improve right away, but it's only removing the risk factor. It just sounds a bit more difficult because we are talking about adrenalectomy rather than a medication for diabetes. But ultimately, it's the same decision-making.
Well, we have another case that we want to get to. So, Mobeen, what does Ms. Rennell decide? Is she getting an adrenalectomy? Do we have an end to the case that you want to just make up off the top of your head?
Oh, yeah. You know, Ms. Rennell, she ends up going for the adrenalectomy after talking with Dr. Bankos. she has improvement in her hypertension and is able to get off of amlodipine 5 milligrams daily. And her most recent A1C is 5.7. So things are looking better and better for Ms. Rennell. And I guess we can go on to the second case, which I think we'll kind of talk about further in terms of like post-surgical management. So the second case that we have here, Mr. Max Adamnoma, he is a 45-year-old male with a past medical history of type 2 diabetes. He's on metformin 1,000 milligrams twice a day and dapagliflozin 10 milligrams daily. Also has a history of hypertension on amlodipine 10 milligrams daily and hydrochlorothiazide 25 milligrams, and also obesity with a BMI of 36. So he presents to your clinic actually for back pain. He presented to the ER last week due to back pain and was found to have an L2 vertebral compression fracture on a CT of his abdomen pelvis. The patient denies any recent trauma, previous fractures, or family history of fractures or metabolic bone disease. He was also incidentally found to have a 2.5 centimeter left adrenal nodule measuring 6 Hounsfield units. Vital signs show his blood pressure is a little bit high at 138 over 92. Heart rate is normal at 80 beats per minute with a respiratory rate of 13 breaths per minute. Physical exam just demonstrates generalized obesity. However, no obvious signs of Cushing syndrome. Looking for any secondary causes of osteoporosis and evaluating his adrenal nodule, your workup is only positive for a 1 milligram dexamethasone suppression test, which shows his cortisol is 5 micrograms per deciliter the next morning, and his dexamethasone level is adequate. ACTH is also checked, and the ACTH level, in this case, let's say it's 4 picograms per milliliter, and DHEAS is 38 micrograms per deciliter. After discussing with the results of the workup with this patient, he is interested in undergoing adrenalectomy for his mild autonomous cortisol secretion. So I guess, Dr. Bancos, we kind of wanted to talk about, in this case, you know, let's say this guy goes for adrenalectomy. Post-surgically, what are things that we need to look out for these patients? You know, are they at risk of adrenal insufficiency? And kind of what is your, like, what do you look for post-surgically in these patients?
Yeah, that's another great case. So just a comment first, both of the cases had dexamethasone suppression test at a higher degree. Cortisol was really 4 in the first case, and in this particular person, it was 5 microns per deciliter, and that's above average. The median dexamethasone suppression test would be around 3, just to give a feel to people. So most of the patients I see with MAX have cortisol between 2 and 3.5, I should say. So this particular person definitely has a higher degree of MAX and as such more likely to develop postoperative adrenal insufficiency, especially with very low ACTH. We recently published a multi-center cohort study. I believe 5 centers participated and contributed. And in that study, we showed that 55% of patients undergoing unilateral adrenalectomy for MAX developed postoperative adrenal insufficiency. And on average, if the person developed adrenal insufficiency, it would last around 4 months. Although there was a wide variability, some patients recovered sooner, some patients took longer. Several factors were associated with a higher likelihood of postoperative adrenal insufficiency. Patients who were younger, women who had higher cortisol after 1 milligram dexamethasone suppression test, higher biochemical severity score of hypercortisolism, and those with unilateral disease, meaning they have just one single nodule rather than bilateral nodule, were the ones more likely to develop postoperative adrenal insufficiency. But that said, none of these factors were sufficiently predictive on their own. They don't allow us to reliably identify pre-surgically who will and who will not develop adrenal insufficiency, which is why post-operative assessment for cortisol status is essential. Now, before we go to how we would assess for post-operative adrenal insufficiency, I just wanted to highlight the high percentage of patients with MAX developing adrenal insufficiency. 55%, what does it mean? It means that the contralateral adrenal gland, the normal gland, the one that is left behind, is atrophic. So that mild degree of cortisol production from that nodule was enough to completely suppress cortisol production from the otherwise normal adrenal gland. That by itself should tell us that MAX is a clinically significant disorder. And the 45% of those who did not develop adrenal insufficiency, the question is why? Is it because we diagnosed it earlier before that adrenal atrophy occurred? Or is it because those people have bilateral MAX, they have nodules on both sides? So something to be clarified in future studies, but just wanted to point out that at least in retrospect in these patients, we can understand even more how clinically significant that MAX was.
Yeah, wow, that's a great point. I mean, 55%, that number, mm-hmm. that seems high.
It's a big number.
Yeah. Yep. Paul, you know, like we've talked about this with other conditions where sometimes people don't know that they feel off until like you kind of like diagnose or just fix the problem. And then they're like, oh, I feel totally different. I think we talked about this with like parathyroidectomy maybe.
Yeah.
So I wonder if this is a similar thing where some people just have some of these symptoms you can't quite put your fingers on, and then when they get the adrenalectomy, they feel better.
Yeah, and I think that deserves a bit of a longer answer, so I'll get there. But maybe should we first talk about how do we assess for adrenal insufficiency?
Sure.
Because opinions vary there. Again, I should just say that the guidelines say start everyone on steroids, don't test. But I think it's because in many centers in the world, and the guidelines are written for the world, not just for United States, there is no possibility to test cortisol quickly the morning after surgery. I think here in the United States, most settings, hospital settings, are able to measure cortisol the morning after surgery and get the results quickly. And this is what we do at our institution. We would measure cortisol the morning after surgery to decide who needs steroids and who doesn't. Those who have adrenal insufficiency based on the testing get started on glucocorticoid replacement therapy until they recover. And those who have excellent testing, meaning that their remaining adrenal gland is functioning properly, do not need to be started on glucocorticoid. So around half of the people would be saved from unnecessary glucocorticoid therapy if we do that. Now, the question is like, how do you assess? Do you just do cortisol in the morning? Or do you do casintropin stimulation test? I think we have not yet reached final conclusion on that. I know that as of now, until we determine what's best for our patients, what we do at our institution is do casintropin stim test. So we look at both baseline cortisol and peak cortisol. And actually, if any of those are abnormal, and we use a cutoff of 10 for the baseline, a cutoff of 18 microns per deciliter for the peak. So if any of those are abnormal, we would diagnose adrenal insufficiency and discharge in glucocorticoids and reassess in outpatient setting. But I think as we get more data, we may be able to maybe simplify the assessment for cortisol production. I think if we had at least basal or baseline cortisol in the morning, that would be good enough to diagnose most of the people with adrenal insufficiency after surgery.
And the stim test, is that just giving like synthetic ACTH essentially?
That's right. So we use a standard casintropin stim test, which is, again, synthetic ACTH, as you said, 250 micrograms being injected. Mm-hmm. So what does it really do? Remember, this person have only one adrenal gland. If it's atrophic adrenal gland, whether you measure cortisol at baseline or you inject a person with a lot of ACTH, synthetic ACTH, cortisol production would be abnormal because the adrenal gland is atrophic, so it just cannot produce cortisol. But imagine that it's not completely atrophic, or there are some nodules that are capable of cortisol production. In that case, baseline cortisol could be still low because, you know, it's not enough to produce sufficient cortisol, but it would respond perfectly to casintropin because as nodules are capable of cortisol production and responding to ACTH, it's just this person does not have their own endogenous ACTH production. So despite an optimal response to casintropin, they would not do well on their own because their own pituitary gland is not producing enough ACTH in this case.
Hmm. And I think another question that comes up, Dr. Benkos, at least when we've seen it in the hospital, is, you know, when we have patients who have overt Cushing syndrome, you know, people feel really terrible once you take out their adrenal gland if you were to just put them on what we consider physiologic doses of, you know, hydrocortisone or prednisone, you know, with glucocorticoid withdrawal syndrome. In terms of patients with this mild autonomous cortisol secretion, what dose are you often sending people on? And also, are these patients at risk of developing glucocorticoid withdrawal syndrome as well?
Yeah, great question. So I do want first to point out there is a difference between adrenal insufficiency and glucocorticoid withdrawal syndrome. So adrenal insufficiency is a biochemical diagnosis that clearly shows that remaining adrenal gland does not produce sufficient amounts of cortisol. And if we just replace it physiologically, the patient should have no symptoms. Glucocorticoid withdrawal syndrome is a phenomenon that happens with any addiction. For example, alcohol withdrawal, smoking withdrawal, heroin withdrawal, or as I like telling my patients, coffee withdrawal. Whenever someone is used to a particular substance in amounts that are supraphysiologic, we develop tolerance to it. And then if we withdraw it, you develop symptoms. For example, if I no longer drink my 6 cups of coffee a day, and tomorrow I wake up and say, okay, I'm quitting coffee cold turkey and I drink 0 cups of coffee, I'll probably feel quite unwell. I'll develop coffee withdrawal with fatigue and irritability and severe headache, and I probably would feel this way for weeks until I finally get used to living without coffee, without caffeine. Well, really the same concept applies to patients recovering from MAX or Cushing's. We take away what they've had in supraphysiological amounts, at least at some parts of the day, and they may develop glucocorticoid withdrawal that is characterized by arthralgias, myalgias. Patients often say that, I feel like I have a flu without a flu, my whole body aches. Fatigue, nausea, palpitations, sometimes some other symptoms as well. So yes, it certainly can happen in patients with MAGs. It's less likely to happen in patients with MAGs than in patients with overt Cushing's, but sometimes I'm surprised. I think what we cannot assess is duration of MAGs and for how long a person has it. And I suspect that those with long-term undiagnosed MAGs may have more severe withdrawal, despite the fact that biochemical degree of MAGs is actually not that bad. So we should counsel our patients about it. And what helps in this case is a slower taper of glucocorticoids. For example, I would start with 10 milligrams of prednisone rather than 5. 5 would be considered physiologic for most patients, but I would start with double of that and then slowly go down to 9 milligrams each morning. Then 1 week later, 8, then 7, 6, 5, and stay on 5 until they recover from adrenal insufficiency. Why this gradual taper? It's because we need to give that body some sort of time to get used to lower and lower or healthy and healthier levels of cortisol. I think to make a parallel to my coffee addiction, if I wanted to quit coffee, instead of going from 6 cups a day to 0, I probably would go to 5 cups a day for a week, then to 4 cups a day for a week, then to 3 cups, then to 2, then to 1, and then quit. And probably I would feel less rough doing it this way rather than just going to 0.
Sure. I think that's an excellent point, and I think something that we definitely see. And you know, I guess thinking about the future, when you, let's say you have a patient who has, you've diagnosed with adrenal insufficiency after adrenalectomy, kind of how do you decide that the patient is able to come off of the glucocorticoid months down the line? Kind of what testing do you do?
Yeah, so you could do it different ways. What I do is I rely on cortisol testing. So once my patient is on 5 milligrams of prednisone each morning for at least 2 weeks to give a chance for HPA axis to recover, I ask my patient to hold their prednisone in the morning until after they provide blood for cortisol testing. And if that cortisol is 10 micrograms per deciliter or higher after holding those glucocorticoids for 24 hours, we generally feel comfortable stopping glucocorticoid therapy completely. So we go from 5 to 0. If cortisol is lower than that, certainly if it's lower than 5, but even if it's between 5 and 10, I continue 5 milligrams of prednisone a day and then retest again, maybe 6 weeks later. And then again, if cortisol is 10 or above, I would stop prednisone and declare recovery from adrenal insufficiency. And if it's not, I will continue the same approach. I very seldomly do casinotropin stimulation tests in these cases, but I do find it useful to at least occasionally to measure ACTH in addition to cortisol, because we are seeing that ACTH becomes high normal, even above normal ranges, right before cortisol recovery. So pituitary gland remembers how to produce optimal ACTH a bit earlier than obviously adrenal cortex remembers how to recover from atrophy.
And 5 of prednisone is not enough to suppress the ACTH from the pituitary and just endogenous cortisol production?
Not enough if it's administered in the morning.
Okay.
Only as one single dose, because it's the half-life or how long it's sort of in the body is usually 16 hours. So by the time the patient is falling asleep in the evening, they don't have any prednisone floating around. And then they have, 8-10 hours of no cortisol whatsoever coming exogenously. And that's the time when pituitary gland recovers. In fact, that's a common question that I get. Is it better to be on prednisone or hydrocortisone for glucocorticoid replacement after curative surgery for MAGs or Cushing's? And we've recently published a paper showing that it does not matter as far as recovery, whether you start prednisone or hydrocortisone at equivalent potency dosing, which is 5 milligrams of prednisone to 20 milligrams of hydrocortisone. Mm-hmm. Recovery or duration of adrenal insufficiency is identical between patients.
I'm kind of assuming postoperatively, smart people like you and Mobeen will be sort of managing the steroids and figuring this stuff out and doing the testing. So my question for you is sort of longer term. This patient comes to see their primary care doctor and follow up. Are there circumstances where we should be worried about delayed adrenal insufficiency? I guess what should prompt testing? What is the long-term kind of evaluation of this look like? Because oftentimes, you know, after the acute stuff's done, specialist visits kind of taper off. So what should I be worried about in the long term for these patients?
Yeah. So adrenal insufficiency, if it happens, it happens right away. So really, we should diagnose it as soon after adrenalectomy as possible. And if the patient recovered from adrenal insufficiency and prednisone is stopped, that person is no longer at risk for developing adrenal insufficiency, unless we give them that person another risk factor, such as exogenous, I don't know, glucocorticoid injections or opiate therapy and so on. I also think that this cutoff of cortisol of 10, let's say you inherit a patient on prednisone 5 and no one knows whether they still have adrenal insufficiency or not. And that doesn't have to be after adrenalectomy for Max or Cushing's. It could also be a patient on longstanding prednisone therapy tapered down from 20 milligrams to 5 and you're wondering, can I stop prednisone from the adrenal insufficiency point of view? That cutoff of 10 micrograms per deciliter is in the guidelines for glucocorticoid-induced adrenal insufficiency. Say it's also in several papers for recovery. And I would say it's pretty safe to remember for any clinician and not rely on endocrinologists. So hold prednisone for 24 hours, measure cortisol in the morning. If it's 10 or above, the person does not have adrenal insufficiency.
Is there anything else that in primary care we should look for? There's a lot of overlap, like some of these things that we're not sure if Max, you mentioned high blood pressure, dyslipidemia, diabetes, of course, obesity. These are things we're used to dealing with. And like, it's so common that I think that's maybe why you were suggesting it's hard to know if that was the cause and that therefore, if having an adrenalectomy is going to cure those things or make them better. But is there anything else we should be monitoring in primary care, like DEXA scans or something? We mentioned bone is something that can be affected by Cushing's, but what about Max?
Yeah, so I feel like there are two settings where appropriate monitoring and primary care is essential, just because there's not enough endocrinologists in the world. So one is a bit more urgent after adrenalectomy. Let's say your patient had Max, had surgery in a referral center, and maybe tapering prednisone, or maybe did not have adrenal insufficiency. So if that person had hypertension and diabetes, especially if diabetes was treated with insulin or sulfonylurea type of drugs, that patient is at risk for hypotension from the hypertension point of view or hypoglycemia from diabetes point of view if the medications are not being tapered down. Because if that person's hypertension and diabetes were partially or fully due to Max, that should improve and potentially no longer require that therapy. So I feel like monitoring of blood pressures and readjustment of antihypertensive, monitoring of blood sugars and readjustment of hypoglycemic therapy is quite important in this acute situation. Usually the first 3 months is when most of the changes occur.
And this was a question I meant to ask before. So for say the patients don't see you, and so we don't have the 95% success rate of going to surgery, and instead they opt to not be surgerized, or they have contraindications, you know, for whatever reason. Are there preferred agents for managing the sequelae of Max? Are there preferred medications for the hyperglycemia seen with Max or for the hypertension, or does it, you just treat it the same as you would hypertension, diabetes elsewhere?
Yeah, so definitely in the second setting would be conservative follow-up of Max. And in that case, we have to treat hypertension, diabetes, and everything else with standard of care medication. There is not something like specific to Max that those comorbidities need different treatment. I know that you asked also about bone health. The guidelines actually were not very clear on the follow-up with DEXA scans, mainly because Max impacts quality much more than density, but bone density does not look at quality. It looks at density, so you're actually missing an opportunity to see or to predict fractures. Having said that, if you can get a bone density with trabecular bone score measurement, that's much better. TBS, trabecular bone score, that's a much better assessment of quality and more appropriate for cortisol-induced bone disease. But otherwise, it's really monitoring for hyperglycemia, hypertension, obesity, osteoporosis, and counseling of, you know, management of depression and anxiety that is potential to sleep, to Max, management of insomnia, potentially due to Max. It's a lot of work if you don't do adrenalectomy for Max. I'm not sure if it's easier.
And speaking of that, you know, Dr. Bengos, like, you know, mild autonomous cortisol secretion, obviously, it's a new and very emerging and exciting field. One thing that I was curious about is, you know, have there been long-term studies now, like in patients who have had adrenalectomy, in terms of like the various outcomes, like cardiovascularly, in terms of vertebral fracture risk, thromboembolism, like kind of curious what the data has shown there.
Yeah, this field really exploded in the last 5 to 10 years. You know, from renaming subclinical Cushing's into MACs in 2016. Why the rename? Because it's not really subclinical. It's a clinical, very evidently clinical problem. Then to sort of renaming ACS to MACs, and then all of the clinical trials and systematic reviews. What we currently have is actually short-term clinical trials, 5 maybe in total, if I'm counting correctly. But most of them have like 6 months follow-up. So really short-term follow-up that, and they all do show improvement in cardiometabolic risk. If you do adrenalectomy versus you conservatively manage, you usually see improvement in hypertension and diabetes and dyslipidemia, at least in one trial. But really, we need longer-term trials, and we need to also look at other outcomes our patients care about. What about sleep? What about quality of life? What about bone disorders? There is one clinical trial looking at vertebral fracture that shows decline in vertebral fractures with adrenalectomy, but that's it. Now, we've recently published a prospective cohort study, and I think the only prospective cohort study of sort of unselected cohort of MACs and Cushing's, and looked at what happens 12 months after. And we have shown, again, anywhere between, what was it, 15 and 50% improvement in this cardiometabolic risk 12 months after surgery. Yeah, but we do need many more studies. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for coming on and talking to us about this. Primary care doctors need to know about it, because as obviously we see a lot of adrenal incidentalomas, and since this is the most common way that those might be functioning, we should know about this. So thank you for your time on that. At this point, I want to ask you for your take-home points that you want the audience to remember, just maybe 2 or 3 things if they don't remember anything else from this talk.
Yeah. So number one, just a general adrenal incidentaloma take-home point. Remember that any person with an adrenal mass needs evaluation for malignancy risk and evaluation for hormonal excess, not just MACs, but also primary aldosterone and catecholamine excess. That also means that some patients may not need to be monitored, because we can actually exclude some of the things right away and discharge them, at least from that point of view. So my second take-home point is that everyone with adrenal mass needs 1 milligram dexamethasone suppression test, and consider MACs as a cardiovascular risk factor, quality of risk, quality of life risk factor, sleep factor in your patients with adrenal nodules. And number 3, remember that we endocrinologists love MACs and talking about it.
Yeah. Well, we love talking to you about it. Is there anything you would like to plug before we let you go?
I think I'm okay.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Perfect answer. Yeah, thank you. This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
Thank you. So every time we have a co-host on, their job is to preempt Matt from saying holes. So strong work, mission accomplished, Mobeen. Still hungry for more? Join our Patreon and get all of our episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find our show notes at thecurbsiders.com. And while you're there, sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox. This includes our Curbsiders Digest, which recaps the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine.
And we're committed to high-value practice-changing knowledge, and we want your feedback, so email us at askcurbsiders@gmail.com. Reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. Special thanks to our writer and producer for this episode, Dr. Mobeen Ahmad, and to our whole Curbsiders team. Our technical production is done by the team at PodPaste. Elizabeth Proto does our social media. Jen Watto runs our Patreon. Chris the Chew Manchu moderates our Discord. Stuart Brigham composed our theme music. And with all that, until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
Dr. Mobeen Ahmad.
And as always, I remain Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Thank you and goodbye.